If you're anything like me, you're always hunting for stories that make your skin crawl, in the best way. That's why I have to tell you about Grimly. Every week, they dig into the unholy, the unsolved, and the deeply unsettling. From chilling true crime to eerie tales that blur the line between fact and folklore, the production is hauntingly good, the storytelling, absolutely captivating. It's the kind of podcast that stays with you long after you finish listening. So if you're ready to explore the darker side of history and humanity, subscribe to Grimly wherever you get your podcasts. Just don't say I didn't warn you.
All right, stop what you're doing, because I'm about to ruin the image and the style that you're used to. Yeah, okay. Totally went there. I didn't know I could rap. I can't, by the way. I really can't. But for real, I don't care if you're driving right now, if you're folding laundry, doing your makeup. But literally, I need you to stop and listen to this today, because what I'm about to tell you is something that I genuinely cannot believe more people don't know about it. And we're going back to Chicago. For some reason, Chicago has just got a lot of shit going on every time I research, and it keeps popping up. So I'm like, all right, why not? Let's just go there. So this is a bridge in Chicago. It is the Clark Street Bridge. And you honestly, if you're in the Midwest, you've probably have walked over this. I mean, tourists take photos on it. Restaurants, you know, totally line the riverfront right below it. And on a summer night, if you look down into the water, people have reported seeing faces, hands reaching up, mouths open, like they are screaming. Now, when I first came across that clickbait, because it was, I was like, okay, all y'all are just drunk by the river on Clark Street, you know, whatever. And then as I went on, I was like, oh, okay, no, you're not. Nope, that's not just a drunken situation. So police get called multiple times regarding this bridge on the regular. People genuinely have thought that someone was drowning. But then, of course, when the officers show up, nothing, and like no one is there. It's just the river. And that is the story, or this is the story, excuse me, of SS Eastland. And I promise you, my fellow creepy crew, by the time we are done today, you are never going to look at Chicago the same way. Because when you look back at the stories we covered, we just did Archer Avenue. We've done H.H. Holmes. We've done the Sausage King of Chicago. For some reason, and when I go through stuff and I start doing my research and I like think of the most stupid fucking questions, like, hey, is there a street named after my dog? And then I find out it's a spooky street, and you know, like all these things for Archer Avenue. Like, that's how I find this stuff. And for some reason, Chicago keeps following me, kind of like the year 1912 keeps following me. And it's really weird. And I don't know if it's because I'm in the Midwest, if something's going on in my Google algorithm. I have no idea. But here we are. And that's just the way it is. So, hey, welcome back. Glad you're here. And if you have not yet, please make sure that you click the subscribe button. And P.S., if you are feeling oh so generous, it would really, really mean the world to the podcast if you would just take 120 seconds and write a review today. It would mean the most, because we really want to get this podcast in front of more people as much as we can. So here we go. This today, we are going to go deep, like for real, like I mean abyss deep, into one of the most devastating, heartbreaking, and genuinely haunted events in American history, and there was nothing better yet for this summer series. Like, I am excited about this, but that's also like your little bit of warning of how deep this is going to go. And this is like literally an event that killed more people than the Titanic's passenger list, an event that wiped out 22 entire families in under 20 minutes, and an event that the city of Chicago has somehow largely forgotten. And it all happened 20 feet from shore. So yeah, you're going to need to go grab your favorite bevy, cozy up, and let's get into this.
If you're anything like me, you're always hunting for stories that make your skin crawl in the best way. That's why I have to tell you about Grimly. Every week, they dig into the unholy, the unsolved, and the deeply unsettling. From chilling true crime to eerie tales that blur the line between fact and folklore. The production is hauntingly good. The storytelling, absolutely captivating. It's the kind of podcast that stays with you long after you finish listening. So if you're ready to explore the darker side of history and humanity, subscribe to Grimly wherever you get your podcasts. Just don't say I didn't warn you.
Okay, so first, I need to paint you a picture, of course, because context is everything here. So it's July 24th, 1915. It's a Saturday morning in Chicago. The air is cool, a little drizzly. One of those like summer days where the sky can't, you know, quite make up its mind. And thousands of people are flooding down to the banks of the Chicago River, like just buzzing with excitement, right? Because today is the day of the Western Electric Company picnic. Now, Western Electric, for those who don't know, ran the Hawthorne Works Factory out in Cicero. Yep, I said it right. Cicero, Illinois. And these weren't executives or like upper management getting on these boats. These were literally everyday workers, immigrants, mostly Czech families, Polish families, Eastern Europe communities who had come to America, settled in Chicago, and were were working the floor of this factory, you know, to build a life. And they extended from like machinists and wire workers, line operators, people who like earned their wages by hand. And once a year, Western Electric threw them a party, like a real one, a full day trip across Lake Michigan to Michigan City, Indiana. There was food, games, music, parades. 7,000 tickets had been sold. 7,000 people had paid 75 cents a piece, which in 1915 was real money for a factory worker. Oh, gosh, put that into perspective, honestly. And so they were to board one of five chartered steamships and have this one perfect summer day. Like, it honestly, it sounds like a lot of fun. Like, it really does. Like, I'd be on board with this. This could be a good time. Who knows? Even though I'm not very social that way. But, you know, maybe I would go. I would probably go. Yeah, I'd probably go. Anyway, doesn't matter. That's who was on that dock. There were no elites, not the wealthy. It was just regular, hardworking people who saved up for a day off. They were dressed for it. Contemporary accounts describe women in white summer dresses. Oh, that's almost like a bad omen. One little boy, 7 years old, by the name of Willie, that is so cute, Willie, had been put in a brand new suit by his parents for the occasion. And like, can you imagine that? A new suit for the picnic, and he's probably just like so proud, and it's probably got like this cute little bow tie. Oh, I bet he's a cute little pipsqueak. So a kid who probably, you know, didn't even sleep like the night before, right? Because he was probably too excited. Now, one of the five boats chartered for the trip is called the SS Eastland. And this is where, of course, our story gets complicated, because this, like, seriously, this boat, this boat's got a reputation, let me tell you. And here's what gets me, and I mean this seriously, like, it really gets me, because once you know this part that I'm going to share with you, the rest of the story stops being just a tragic situation and starts being more infuriating. And I am not kidding you, because as I went through some of this, like, no joke, I guarantee you today you are going to say, are you fucking kidding me? Like, those are going to be your words. I'm telling you. Okay, here we go. Let's find out. So the SS Eastland was actually known for being unstable. Like, it wasn't even rumored. It wasn't even speculated. Like, this was known, it was documented, and it was on record. The ship had been built in 1902 and launched in 1903, originally designed to carry 650 passengers. Right from its first season in 1904, there were problems. The ship had a narrow hull and a high superstructure, which basically means it was wide on the top and narrow at the bottom. So it was built for speed and not stability. They called it the Speed Queen of the Great Lakes, and also, and less glamorously, the Greyhound of the Lakes. But speed and stability don't always really go together, if you know what I mean. And almost immediately, the Eastland started showing people that it what it was really about. So July 1904, its very first season, ship's very first season, the ship nearly capsized at her berth in South Haven, Michigan during loading. Passengers had crowded to one side because, you know, like back in the day when ships would leave port, they would all like wave to everybody on the dock, right? Like, bye, see you later, love you. Like, we know that scene, right? We know that scene. And so, unfortunately, the whole ship lurched like dangerously. So first season, 1 year in, okay? They made modifications. Sold the ship, more modifications, sold it again, and the ship changed hands multiple times over the following years because nobody wanted to deal with the liability of it. And quite frankly, I don't really blame them. This sounds like a fucking death trap, to be honest. So in 1905, the ship listed so badly in Cleveland that a gangplank collapsed and threw several passengers into the water. In 1906, while docked in Chicago, the Eastland listed hard enough that furniture slid across the decks. Okay, that's probably not good, right? Now, a naval architect actually put this in writing. In 1913, he formally warned officials that unless the ship's structural defects were fixed, and I'm honestly kind of paraphrasing here, but barely, there may be a serious accident. Do you think they fixed it? Of course they fucking didn't. So they did not. They did not fix it. They increased the passenger capacity instead. Uh-huh. And we all remember the Titanic, right? Speaking of 1912, in 1912, the Titanic sinks. The world is deeply horrified by this, right? Like, everyone knows the Titanic is probably the most famous ship sinking ever. The United States government responds by passing a Seamen's Act of 1915, which required all passenger vessels to carry enough lifeboats for every person on board. Sounds good, right? Like, that's responsible, perhaps even noble, if you will. Except nobody thought through what that meant for the ship, like the Eastland, a ship that was already top heavy. A ship that was already dangerously unbalanced. You take that ship and you bolt heavy lifeboats onto the upper deck, the very top of an already top-heavy structure, and you have made the problem dramatically worse. Like, hello? Okay. I tell you, I'm already getting up on my soapbox on this one, you guys. The law meant to save lives after the Titanic, and it may have, like seriously, the law meant to save it, right? But it may have directly contributed to killing 844 people on the Chicago River 3 years later. And here's what makes me genuinely angry every time I think about this. Steamboat inspectors, aware of all this history, signed off on increasing the Eastland's passenger capacity just before the 1915 picnic season. Why? Because the summer had been slow. And guess what it all fucking boils down to, folks? They needed to make money. Because the Eastland needed to pull more passengers per trip to turn a profit. So we have a ship that nearly capsized multiple times over the course of 11 years that engineers had flagged as dangerous in writing, I might add, that had been loaded with additional top deck weight, and they increased its capacity and packed it full of factory workers and, I'm sorry, their children. Like, that is not a ghost story. That's a fucking crime, honestly. So, all right, let's get it to, like, the morning of, okay? So, July 24th, 1915. The Eastland is docked on the south bank of the Chicago River between Clark and LaSalle Streets. Now, five lines secure it to the dock, okay? Boarding begins at 6:30 in the morning. Now, the Eastland was scheduled to be the first boat to leave that day, and people wanted to be the first on the boat, right? Maybe it felt like an adventure. Maybe it felt like getting a good seat, whatever the reason, right? People flooded onto the Eastland, over 2,500 of them, packed onto a ship that, even in its modified state, was certified for far fewer. Now, the atmosphere on board is festive. A band was playing on the dock. People were waving to each other, calling out to friends. Women were holding their children's hands. Someone had, you know, brought flowers. Okay, you get the idea. Now, between 7:10 and 7:15 in the morning, the ship had not yet left the dock. It began to list. Not like dramatically at first, a slight lean to the port side, away from the wharf. Okay. So passengers on the port side had gathered to wave to the crowd on the riverfront, right? That's what we're talking about, to watch other boats coming in. It's all very simple as that. The weight shifted. The water ballast tanks, which were supposed to compensate for this kind of thing, were not functioning correctly. The crew tried to fill the tanks to stabilize the ship, but the tanks weren't filling fast enough or evenly enough. Now, this is where I feel very strongly that common sense began to wane. And common sense, unfortunately, is just not that common. Like, honestly. So, because my thought is, wouldn't, as a captain, like, I don't have boating experience, really. I mean, you know, no way am I a captain by any means. But my thought would be, all right, you know what? We're going to be delayed. But safety first, let's get all these people off, fill these tanks, and try to load again. Now, and if some people don't get to go, then you know what? We'll refund their money. We'll give them something else extra as an apology. I don't know. It's 1915. People were a lot more generous back then. And I'm just saying there were options, but you didn't make the right one. That's all I'm saying. Okay. Now, people on the dock noticed, right? Like, warehouse workers were shouting, "Look out, she's tipping." The harbor master saw it. People on shore saw this. And at 7:28 a.m., the Eastland lurched sharply to port. And then, in what survivors described as horribly slow motion, the entire ship rolled on its side. Oh, I got goosebumps, you guys. Seriously, I need to take a picture of this. Like, oh my gosh. Okay, completely, fully flat on its side in the Chicago River, 20 feet from shore, in 20 feet of water. Yeah. Now, a survivor by the name of Joseph, and I think I'm going to say it right, Kostaki, described it this way. All of a sudden, just as the boat seemed to be pulling out from the dock, she began to list and slowly teetered over away from the dock. Hundreds rushed toward the dock side and many jumped overboard. Women and children became frantic. Nobody seemed to know what to do. Few thought of life preservers. There was little time to think about anything. Shortly, the air was filled with screams of horror. Whew. Again, seriously, my hair is standing on edge. I am envisioning this right now. The people on the upper decks were thrown into the river. Some survived by clinging to the hull, to ropes, you know, basically to anything. But the people in the lower decks, like the lounges, the cabins, the enclosed spaces below the waterline, very sadly, they had no chance. The water flooded in like instantly, and there was no warning, no time to react. For them, it was instant. That is horrifying. Whew. Okay. A coroner's physician later examined the bodies as they were brought ashore, and he determined that the majority had not drowned. They had suffocated, trapped in air pockets under the steel hull. The oxygen ran out before help could arrive. That is so sad. That is so sad. And help? While it did come, and it came fast, thankfully, but it could not come fast enough for 844 people. Okay. Now, I want to take a moment here because in the middle of absolute chaos, there were people who did really extraordinary things. The response from Chicago was immediate and absolutely fierce. Like firefighters, police officers, divers, civilian volunteers, they were all in that water within minutes. I'm going to be honest, nowadays, I don't know how fast that would happen. And just to give you a little bit of perspective, I'll share this little side story. Over the weekend, I took my kiddo to the splash pad. We've been living at the splash pad. It's summer, right? And my daughter and I got tangled and I tripped and I fell. And I landed hard, you guys. I landed really hard. And I have a huge bruise on my knee. Not a single person. I'm more mad about this. Not a single person ever got up to see if we were okay, if you know, anything like, oh, I'm sorry, or just anything, I would have absolutely gotten up and been like, oh my gosh, are you okay? Like, just that, like, God, it just infuriates me so much. So the fact that these people just were like, no questions asked, and got in that water and were trying to do anything and everything to help their fellow man, that is a hero right fucking there. Okay. That's my two cents on that. And I think it's awesome. Now, okay. Hang on. Where are my notes? I've got notes. I use notes. Please hold. Okay. So one account describes a young man who jumped off the docks at LaSalle Street 6 times, pulling a drowning woman, like a different drowning woman, to safety each time. On his 7th dive, he didn't come back. He either cramped or simply had nothing left, and he disappeared. That is so sad. Rescuers could hear tapping from inside the hull, faint rhythmic tapping, people still alive, trapped inside the steel, knocking on the walls. Oh, this is so horrific. Rescue workers eventually used like torches to cut holes through the starboard side of the ship and pull survivors out one by one. The captain of the Eastland actually tried to stop them. Can you believe that? He didn't want damage to the hull. Sir, your boat is on its fucking side. I don't think it matters anymore at this point. I would have totally disregarded him. The police had him arrested on the spot. Yes. Brilliant. Now, okay. The Reed, Murdoch, and Company building, it's a warehouse that is directly across the river, became the main makeshift morgue. Ironically, its own employees were at a company picnic that day, so the building was empty. Bodies were brought in at a rate of 2 per minute at the peak. They were laid out in rows on the concrete basement floor, numbered, photographed, their belongings placed in envelopes. Families walked through in silence looking for their people. Oh, that is so grim. That is... Whew. Okay. A great wire net had been stretched across the river at LaSalle Street to catch the bodies that were starting to float downstream. So think about that. A net across a river in downtown Chicago on a Saturday morning in July. Nearly 300 of the 844 people who died, and I'm sorry, they were children. And that is really sad. The Czech community was devastated. Western Electric employed a large number of Czech immigrants, and more than 220 of the victims were of a Czech descent. Entire streets in Cicero went into mourning simultaneously. More than 130 victims are buried in a single cemetery. And if you want to know that cemetery, it's the Bohemian National Cemetery in Chicago. And you can absolutely go visit it today if you want to. 22 complete families were lost. Not a single survivor. Entire bloodlines just gone. The grief that hit Chicago was of a different texture than normal tragedy. It wasn't one disaster that struck randomly. It was one community, neighbors, co-workers, people who knew each other, who had walked to the same dock together that morning, and it had all been taken from them all at once. That is really sad. That is really sad. And I'm sorry to hit you with that heavy, but it's important to the story. So, okay, we have lost 844 people, right? A ship that all the professionals knew was dangerous. Warnings that were documented in writing, inspectors who increased the capacity anyway, a crew that was arrested at the scene. Justice was served, right? Not quite. A coroner's jury eventually found six people responsible, including the ship's owners and the chief engineer. Criminal charges were filed and it went to court. Get this, the verdict? Not guilty. All parties, every single one, not guilty. Yeah. The Court of Appeals threw out all lawsuits against the Eastland's owners. The exact legal cause of the capsizing was ruled undetermined. No one, not one person, was ever held criminally responsible for the deaths of 844 people. Make of that what you will. The families received some relief money from charity organizations and Western Electric itself, which donated $100,000 to recovery efforts. Now, that works out to roughly $118 per victim. In today's money, that would probably only be a few thousand dollars. Really? A few thousand dollars for my lost child or for my entire family that's now gone. Wow. Talk about a slap in the face. Now, the Eastland itself did get raised from the river. I mean, obviously, it's not there anymore. And they renamed it the WSS Wilmette and converted it into a Navy training vessel. It served through World War II, and then it was scrapped. The river moved on, Chicago moved on. The story somehow impossibly totally got forgotten, which is really kind of its own tragedy in and of itself, right? So the part that I keep coming back to, because I think this story honestly faded by accident. So we're going to back it up here. The Titanic, of course, sunk in 1912. 3 years later, something happened in an American city that killed more passengers than the Titanic. And also, P.S., just to back it up, if you remember last year's summer series and I did the Christmas ghost ship, you should totally go back and listen to that because that also happened in 1912. And it's just very interesting how much went on with ship sinking, especially just in those 3 years of 1912 to 1915. Like, it's going to kind of blow your mind. I'm not kidding. So with the whole Titanic situation, you'd think that would be seared into like national consciousness of being safe, right? You'd think that there'd be like movies, documentaries, a memorial that every school kid like visits, right? Well, there are a few theories about why the Eastland vanished from our collective memory. And that's the whole part of this situation that I think is just the most creepy. Okay, so first, it happened 2 months after there was a German boat, and I think you say it Lusitania, if I'm saying that right, Lusitania, I'm not sure if I'm saying it right, but it's Lusitania, was sunk by a German U-boat, killing nearly 1,200 people. The country was consumed with fears of war. The Eastland got buried in the news cycle like almost immediately. Then the second, the there's a few different theories, so hang with me here. The second theory, the victims were immigrants and factory workers, not wealthy passengers, not famous names. The Titanic had first-class cabins and millionaires on board, and the press covered them obsessively. The Eastland had Czech wire workers and their kids in their Sunday best. The coverage was sympathetic, but the story didn't have the cultural weight to make it stick. Thirdly, nobody was punished. With the Titanic, there was a massive inquiry, public hearings, international outrage. With the Eastland, the legal proceedings dragged on and on for years, ended in acquittals, and quietly closed. There was no villain the media could point to, no satisfying resolution, so the story died. And it's been largely dead ever since. There is a small historical plaque between Clark and LaSalle streets today, a marker. If you walk past it on a Tuesday afternoon, you might not even notice it. It's 844 people, a plaque. I genuinely don't have words for that. Like, I really don't. Okay, so here we are. I told you the history. And I've tried to be really clear that this is the first and foremost a human story. Real people, real loss, real grief that rippled through the communities for generations. But this is creepy shit. And the creepy shit is very, very real. The Clark Street Bridge, which sits directly over the site of the Eastland disaster, has been the subject of consistent, documented paranormal reports for over a century. And I want to be specific about that word, consistent, because this isn't one person who had like a weird feeling one night. This is a pattern that has been repeated across decades, across different witnesses, across different types of experiences. Let me start with the most unnerving one, because it is so specific and so verifiable that it genuinely gave me chills when I found it. Paranormal investigators have used underwater microphones, parabolic microphones, not ghost hunting gimmicks on and near the Clark Street Bridge, okay? And they have recorded voices coming from the water, not wind. This isn't like ambient noise, okay? Actual voices. And some of those voices speak in Czech. Czech, the native language of more than 220 people who died in that river more than 100 years later. Underwater recording equipment is picking up voices in a language that was spoken by the people who suffocated in those lower decks. I'm just going to let you sit with that for a second. The visual reports are also equally consistent and, I might add, equally disturbing. From the Chicago River Walk, from the restaurants that lined the banks, from the Clark Street Bridge itself, people report seeing faces in the water, not reflections, faces, looking up, sometimes with hands reaching toward the surface. That is terrifying. These reports have come in often enough and credibly enough that the Chicago police have records of people calling 911 to report a drowning at that location. Officers respond, they check the water, they find nothing, like no person, no disturbance. It's just the river. People have been calling 911 about a drowning that happened in 1915. Now, ghost tour operators in Chicago, and this is a city that takes its ghost tours very seriously, have documented accounts of people experiencing sudden, sharp drops in temperature on the bridge. equipment malfunctions, and an overwhelming feeling of grief or panic that hits without warning and lifts just as suddenly. One account describes a woman on a ghost tour who had no prior knowledge of the Eastland disaster. She joined the tour thinking, you know, okay, this will be good. This will be fun. A little bit of history. She stopped on the Clark Street Bridge and began crying uncontrollably. And she had no clue why. And this kind of reminds me of like what we went through, my husband and I, when we were at Shakers. She just felt suddenly that she was not alone, that there was someone standing next to her who was afraid. Now, look, I'm not going to sit here and tell you what I believe. You honestly, you already know if you've been around here for a while. And you can believe in ghosts and you can believe in, you know, collective psychological imprinting, the idea that spaces absorb trauma and human beings who pass through them pick up on it. Either way, something is happening on that bridge. And then there's the Reed Murdoch building, the building that became the morgue, if you guys remember. 844 bodies were carried through its basement, laid in rows on concrete. Staff who have worked in that building over the decades have reported sounds that don't have sources. There's been crashing and banging late at night that disappear when investigated. Footsteps on staircases. Oh, and this breaks my heart. The sound of children's voices. Security cameras in the building have definitely captured what appear to be moving shapes or figures in empty rooms. There's been cold spots and a persistent sense of being watched. And I want to make something really, really clear here. These aren't people who went looking for a ghost story. These are just everyday employees, people who are just showing up to do their jobs and really don't know the history. The haunting of the Clark Street Bridge and its surrounding area is a curated, spooky attraction. It's something that keeps happening unprompted to people who weren't expecting it. Now, I've been sitting with this story for a little bit, and I want to share where I land on it because I think it matters. There's a question that I keep asking myself when I research stories like this. Why does the haunting happen? Now, I definitely have a lot of theories. Like, I really do. Like, okay, fine. You say you believe in residual energy and spirits and the idea that extreme trauma can leave a mark on a place. Why this place and why still? And I think the answer is justice, is it not? Like more accurately, like the absence of it. Like no justice was ever served for this. To me, that makes the grounds of a residual haunting very highly like that. I feel like it's like almost an inevitable, you know what I mean? The people who died on the Eastland knew, even if they didn't have the words for it, that something was wrong with that boat. The crew knew, the inspectors knew, the owners knew, and none of them were ever held accountable. Not one day in prison, not one civil judgment, that stuck. There was nothing. The families left behind knew it too. They buried their children and their parents and their siblings, and they watched the legal system just go, eh, and walk away. That just angers me so much. They were immigrants, most of them, factory workers, not the kind of people the system was built to fight for in 1915. And so the story got buried along with them. I think that matters spiritually. Whether you believe in a literal afterlife or not, this is something about unresolved grief, unacknowledged injustice, stories that never got told. Yeah, that's going to linger, and that creates echoes. The voices in check coming from that water aren't just a paranormal phenomenon to me. They feel like people who are still trying to be heard. People who died on a boat that everyone knew was dangerous on a day that was supposed to be the best day of the year, and whose story got erased because they weren't the kind of people history tends to remember. I am really not okay with that. And I don't think the river is either. Seriously. So, okay. If this episode hit you, I want to give you some real places to go with that feeling, okay? The Eastland Disaster Historical Society has been working since 1998 to make sure that this story doesn't stay buried, which I love that so much. I love that so much. I'm telling you, when I get into and I'm probably not that far off into my early retirement days, hopefully all I will be doing is being part of some historical society and podcasting. That is what I want my retirement to look like. I'm just podcasting and researching for the rest of my life. That would be the dream come true. But anyway, I digress. So you can absolutely check out their website. Their website is genuinely remarkable. It's honestly where I got a lot of information. They've got victim records. They've got survivor accounts. They've got photographs. It's really, truly fascinating. I would highly recommend that you look them up. If you feel oh so inclined, you can absolutely donate to them, which truth be told, I did, because I'm like, yep, I love this story. It's a very important story in history, and it's got to be told for sure. So I love that. And if you're ever in Chicago, walk the River Walk between Clark and LaSalle Streets. Find the historical plaque. You know, stand there for a minute. You don't have to believe in ghosts to make that happen. You just have to be willing to remember, right? And then the Bohemian National Cemetery on the north side of Chicago is where more than 130 victims are buried. It's a real place. It's visitable. If you want to pay respects in concrete, grounded way, that is definitely the place to do it. And if you want the full experience, then you can definitely go take a walk on Clark Street Bridge at night, stand on it, and if you are very brave, go ahead and look down in the water. See what you see. All right, you guys, that is our episode for today. 844 people, a Saturday morning in July, a boat that should have never been allowed on the water, and a bridge that more than 100 years later still has not let go of what happened beneath it. It's wild. So thank you guys. Thank you for being here. If you love today's episode, again, please make sure that you are subscribed to the podcast or click that follow button. I don't know which one is which. I think it's subscribe on Spotify and follow on Apple, wherever, whatever it is for you. And also too, please, if you can submit a review and just take a few extra seconds and give a 5-star review, it would mean the world. That definitely helps us kick it up our ratings so that more people see us. All right, you guys, until next week, remember, sometimes the creepiest shit is also the truest. Okay, bye.